Well, greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries around the world over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. And the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on the war on gold when we come back. You know, when the federal income tax was launched back in 1913, the tax was levied only upon the super wealthy, the richest one-half of 1% of our total population, with a top tax rate of only 7%. Today, of course, the fears of those early opponents of this tax have been more than fully realized. By the end of Herbert Hoover's term, the top tax rate had jumped to 60%. And by the time Franklin D. Roosevelt was done, the top tax rate was over 90%, and the tax had been dramatically expanded to seize the incomes of the middle class for the first time. In 1913, the average family had to work until January 30th in order to earn enough to satisfy the tax man at all levels. This year, the average American family had to work all the way through May 12th in order to earn enough to pay their federal, state, and local tax bills. Now, when you compare this to the plight of medieval serfs, they only had to work to give the lord of their manor about a third of their output, and they were considered slaves. Now, what does that make us today? This income tax and Social Security tax violate three of the Ten Commandments and eight statutes of the Old Covenant, including our English common law. The income tax and Social Security taxes are two criminal activities. The income tax is the second plank to the Communist Manifesto, and Social Security is the eighth. That's why I contend that you owe it to yourself to at least ask the question, do I really want to participate in this kind of criminal activity? Now, if you'd like more information about tax and status, why don't you call us here at the law school? That's area code 417-273-4967, and be sure to ask for our free general law CD package. That's a four-hour commentary on the law school. It's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative, and it's free of charge. Now, our school, Tax and Status, is available on compact disc for adult home education. If you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email and send us an email request for that free general law CD package. Now, again, that's georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. Do it right now before you forget. All right, we've been talking about The War on Gold, a book written by Anthony Sutton back in 1976. It's just as up-to-date today in 2006 as it was 30 years ago. In fact, I was amazed as I read through the book. I had to keep referring to the inside flycover to find out, geez, when did this guy write this book? We've got the same problems today that we had in 1976, leading into the double-digit inflation and the double-digit interest rate increases in 79-80 and the recession of 81-82. Same problems are extant today, except that the causes of the problems are about 10 times worse than they were back in the 70s. Our debt structure is about 10 times worse than it was back in the 70s. Now, can this go on forever? You know, if the world can go on forever the way it is today, I say I'm all for it, but I'm not sure that the people in China and Asia and Europe are going to continue to supply the United States with the goods and the credit that we need to keep us living the lifestyle that we have now become accustomed to living. It occurs to me that one of these days these people are going to shut us off. And to give you an illustration as to how bad this is, we used to have a shoe industry here in the United States. Believe it or not, we Americans at one time knew how to make shoes. 1% of shoes made in America in 2006 will be made in the United States of America. 99% of the shoes that we buy in this country come from outside of our borders. That's pretty serious if you want to continue wearing shoes. Because if these people ever cut us off for non-payment, like they did to the Argentines here a couple, 3 years ago, then we're going to find ourselves barefoot. The garlic industry, as an illustration, we used to produce garlic in this country from Gilroy, California. It's not a big business. I think it's about a $200 million a year industry, garlic. Just a small thing, no big deal. But the Chinese can supply our garlic for about $4 a pound, and it costs us Americans about $16 a pound. And you guessed it, Americans would rather go to Walmart and pay $4 a pound for Chinese garlic than they would $16 a pound for American garlic, and so our garlic industry is history. Now, as I said, garlic's a small thing, but you know, if the Chinese quit shipping us garlic, you're not going to have garlic to stick into your pot roast next Sunday, assuming that you've got any pot roast to stick the garlic into. And it goes on and on and on. It's automobiles, it's steel, it's aluminum, it's aircraft, it's everything that you can think of. America in 1950 used to be number one in all 15 leading economic indicators of industrial production. 1950, 56 years ago, America was number one. We produced more steel than any other country in the world. We produced more automobiles than any other country in the world. There's 15 of those. Today, in the year 2006, we are not number one in any of those 15 leading economic indicators of industrial production. Not a one. And the standard of living that we have become accustomed to is being financed with paper. We are the world's number one paper hanger. We create paper and buy our goods and services from other countries who, I suppose, honest to God, believe that someday they're going to collect, that they're going to get paid for that paper in Caterpillar tractors or in Cadillac automobiles or something else that we produce here in the United States. But the bottom line to that story is this. We Americans are importing $800 billion a year, and we are exporting $200 billion a year. That's a $600 billion a year shortfall. And when this thing goes upside down, we are going to suffer a shortage of about $600 billion a year in imported goods that we're used to using, you know, day in and day out. Now, that's going to bring your standard of living down, and mine and everybody else's, about three pegs. Maybe a little bit further than three pegs. So you need to get ready for that, and there's a cause for it. So before we get ready for it, let's figure out what the cause is. What's going on here that would change things in America from 1950 to 2006, 56 years? What is it that has changed that now causes us to be the world's number one debtor nation when we used to be the world's number one creditor nation? Well, from the international forecaster, Bob Chapman makes this observation. He said, corporate elitists have robbed us of our economy, our way of life, and our culture. Foreigners are now using America as a dumping ground for relatively inexpensive goods, and these uneducated and diseased that Americans have to borrow to pay for. And we're the world's biggest debtors. Foreigners now own 21% of the GDP worth $2.5 trillion, 9% of U.S. stocks, 17% of corporate bonds, 24% of government bonds. And in 30 years, industry has fallen 50%. We're now only producing 17% of our gross domestic product versus 26% in Europe, which comes from our industrial base. And the litany goes on and on as it gets worse and worse. And then finally, over the past 6 years, the dollar has lost 30% of its purchasing power, 30% in 6 years. Now, when you go back to 1930, the dollar has lost 97% of its purchasing power. Between 2000 and 2006, it's lost 30%. I mean, kids, we're not talking about the collapse of our monetary system. Hell, it's already occurred. All we're talking about is the last 2 or 3 cents of the value of the dollar, which is going upside down. That's all we're talking about. You've already lost 97% of it. Now, in many innovations, the Chinese anticipated the Western world, and their abuse of paper fiat money is just one such instance. Now, the first European use of paper banknotes was recorded in Sweden in 1661. By contrast, Marco Polo, in his travels to China, found that the Chinese had used paper money in the 13th century. The Venetian traveler and explorer presents the following admiring account of the paper money system created by Kublai Khan back in the 13th century. Here's how the great Khan causeth the bark of trees made into something like paper to pass for money over all of his country. And Marco Polo begins his account by saying, now that I have told you in detail of the splendor of the city of the emperors, I shall proceed to tell you of the mint which he hath in the same city, in the which he hath his money coined and struck, as I shall relate to you. And in doing so, I shall make manifest to you how it is that the great Lord may well be able to accomplish even much more than I have told you, or am going to tell you in this book. For tell it how I might, you never would be satisfied that I was keeping within truth and reason. The emperor's mint, then, is in the same city of Cambalac, and the way it is wrought is such that you might say he hath the secret of alchemy in perfection, and you would be right, for he makes his money after this fashion. He makes them take of the bark of a certain tree, in fact of the mulberry tree, the leaves of which are the food of the silkworms. These trees being so numerous that whole districts are full of them. And what they take is a certain fine white bast or skin which lies between the wood of the tree and the thick outer bark. And this they make into something resembling sheets of paper, but they are black. When these sheets have been prepared, they are cut up into pieces of different sizes. The smallest of these sizes is worth a half of a tournesol. The next, a little larger, one tournesol. One a little larger still is worth half a silver groat of Venice. Another a whole groat. Others yet 2 groats, 5 groats, and 10 groats. There is also a kind worth 1 bezant of gold, and others of 3 bezants, and so up to 10 bezants of gold. All of these pieces of paper are issued with as much solemnity and authority as if they were of pure gold or silver. And on every piece, a variety of officials whose duty it is have to write their names and to put their seals. And when all is prepared duly, the chief officer, deputized by the Khan, smears the seal entrusted to him with vermilion. And he impresses upon it, upon the paper, so that the form of the seal remains stamped upon it in red. The money is then authentic, and anyone forging it would be punished with death. And the Khan causes every year to be made such a vast quantity of this money, which costs him nothing, that it must equal in amount all of the treasures in the world. And with these pieces of paper, made as I have described, he causes all payments on his own account to be made, and he makes them to pass currently, universally, over all of his kingdoms and provinces and territories, and whithersoever his power and sovereignty extends. And nobody, however important he may think himself, dares to refuse them on pain of death, and indeed everybody takes them readily. For wheresoever a person may go throughout the great Khan's dominions, he shall find these pieces of paper current, and shall be able to transact all sales and purchases of goods by means of them, just as well as if they were coins of pure gold. And all the while they are so light that 10 bezants worth does not weigh 1 golden bezant. Furthermore, all of the merchants arriving from India or other countries and bringing with them gold or silver or gems and pearls are prohibited from selling to anyone but the emperor. The emperor has 12 experts chosen for his business, men of shrewdness and experience in such affairs. These men appraise the articles, and the emperor then pays a liberal price for them in these pieces of paper. The merchants accept this price readily, because in the first place they would not get so good a price from anybody else, and then secondly, they are paid without any delay. And with this paper money, they can buy what they like anywhere over the empire, whilst it is also vastly lighter to carry about on their journeys. And it is a truth that the merchants will several times in the year bring wares to the amount of 400,000 bezants, and the great sire pays for all of that in paper. So he buys such a quantity of those precious things every year that his treasure is endless, whilst all the time the money he pays away costs him nothing at all. Moreover, several times in the year proclamation is made throughout the cities that anyone who may have gold or silver or gems or pearls by taking them to the mint shall get a handsome price for them. And the owners are glad to do this because they would find no other purchaser who would give so large a price. Thus, the quantity that they bring in is marvelous. Though those who do not choose to do so may let it alone, still in this way, nearly all of the valuables in the country come into the Khan's possession. When any of those pieces of paper are spoilt, not that they are so very flimsy neither, the owner carries them to the mint, and by paying 3% on the value, he gets new pieces of paper in exchange. And if any baron or anyone else soever hath need of gold or silver or gems or pearls in order to make plate or girdles or the like, he goes to the mint and buys as much as he list, paying in this paper money. Now you have heard the ways and means whereby the great Khan may have, and in fact has, more treasure than all the kings in the world, and you know all about it and the reason why. Well, let's pause right there and let's analyze our Federal Reserve, because that's precisely what our Federal Reserve and our government is doing today. They have an endless supply of paper, and they can just create that anytime they want. And all of the great treasures of America that are manufactured or that are imported are bought and paid for with these pieces of paper, and we Americans are the beneficiaries of that. Now, if you take a look at gold of and by itself, about $10 billion a day, that's right, $10 billion worth of gold a day is traded on the London Merchants Exchange. But 82% of this gold is transacted on pieces of paper, contracts for future delivery. So when you're looking in the paper, you see that gold for December delivery is selling at $602. So somebody bought a contract for future delivery of gold from the Bank of England or the Federal Reserve or the Reserve or the Deutsche Bank or somebody, and for future delivery in December. Now, the guy that holds that piece of paper doesn't physically have any gold. That's on deposit over here in some bank, some warehouse. It could be the TOCOM or it could be the COMEX or some warehouse. Actually physically has that gold on deposit. So there is some real gold out there. There's not as much gold as there is paper, but there is some gold out there. And so if you're holding one of those contracts, you know that you can take that in and that you can physically collect in December when this contract matures for that $601, which you've already bought and paid for in November, October, or September. You can take that in, physically collect the gold, and walk out with it. Now, the making of these paper contracts is without end. It doesn't require very much to push a button on your computer, print out one of these paper contracts for $1 million or $2 million or $5 million or $1,000 or $2,000 or $5,000 or whatever amount you want. And $10 billion a day is being transacted worldwide on the London Metals Exchange. Now, here's the kicker. Over the years, you know, I don't know if it's the last 10, 15, 20, 30, 50 years, well, not 50, but it'd be back to about 1971, when President Nixon closed the gold window of the U.S. Treasury. We have been issuing these paper gold contract certificates. Now, the world produces about 2,500 tons of gold every year. South Africa and Russia and Peru and Ecuador, you know, countries around the world produce gold. And when you tally it all up, it's about 2,500 tons per year. Now, the world consumes about 3,700 tons per year. About 50% more than that is what the world is consuming. Now, you might ask, well, how in the world can you consume 50% more than you produce? The answer is very simple. you just print up a piece of paper that says you own this amount of gold in this warehouse someplace. And that's because only 18% of people, or 18% of the gold by whatever number of people, is actually transacted, or those people actually take physical possession of the gold itself. 82% is on deposit. So let's suppose that we're the warehouse and we have on deposit 1,000 ounces of gold. Well, in theory, we should have no more than 1,000 ounces of gold at any given time out on contract, so that if the people who have those contracts came in, we would have 1,000 ounces of gold to pay those contracts. Now, that's the legal theory. That's the moral equivalent. That's the law that says thou shalt not steal. But since 82% of people never come into the warehouse to pick up their gold, they just buy, sell, and trade these contracts. And they make profit or they make loss on these contracts. And they're happy with doing that because they deal in paper. It's called paper gold. Now, as this process has been going on over the years, the warehouse issued 2,000 ounces of gold worth of paper, so that if everybody came in and demanded their gold, half the people would get paid their gold and half the people would get nothing. They bought and paid for it. They produced their labor or their goods, and they sold those into the marketplace, and they took their credits in paper or computer entries, and they paid for those gold contracts. But if they come in to get them, they're not going to get them. And they just kept doing that until today. There are 15 contracts out there for every ounce of gold that's in the warehouse, which is fine. There's no problem with that. No problem. As long as none of you people go to the warehouse to collect your gold, or certainly not more than 1/15 of you go to the warehouse to collect the gold. And everybody believes that there is full measure, full value, the entire number of ounces in the warehouse for the number of contracts that are out there. Everybody believes that. It's not true. And anybody who's in the gold or silver business knows that that isn't true. In the same way that I pointed out to you the other day, that if we Americans, and you just take all the money that you've got in the bank or all the money you've got in your pocket, and if you just, you and everybody else in America, all went down to your stores, all the stores in America, Walmart and Target and Best Buy, and you went in and you all converted your paper money into goods. You actually take and you convert your paper money into shoes, or you into big screen TVs, or into automobiles. You could only collect, all of us combined, could only collect 2 cents on the dollar. 2 cents. Now, that's a combination of just-in-time delivery, and it's a combination of the economic system in whole, and that's the way the game is. Now, I'm one of those pigs, and I don't have any dollars. I can already converted all of my dollars into goods. I've already got my shoes and wheat, corn, beans, honey, and oil. And then I recommend to my students to do the same thing, because at some point in time, the Chinese are going to say, we want to get paid. And not too long ago, the Chinese, who are now sitting on $1 trillion worth of foreign exchange, of which about a third of that is U.S. dollars, they said they wanted to buy an oil company over here, Unocal, for approximately $20 billion. And we said no. Well, boys and girls, you don't have to be real smart to figure out, you know, if you took your U.S. dollars down to Walmart and you walked in the store and they said, well, you can buy these items over here, but you cannot buy these items over here, you would see in a heartbeat that those dollars aren't nearly as valuable as you thought they were. It's the convertibility of those dollars into those goods and services that you want to buy at any time, in any place, in any circumstance, that gives you the confidence to take those and to use them. And like the Chinese emperor here, if you can use that paper to exchange for goods and services, you know, for practical purposes, that's all well and good. But in the system of paper money, it doesn't take the Kublai Khan very long to figure out that he can buy up all of the property, all of the real wealth with these very inexpensive pieces of paper. And he becomes enormously rich and powerful. And the people who use these pieces of paper become very poverty-stricken, and they become very powerless and very impoverished. And that's where Americans are today, impoverished. And powerless, impoverished and powerless. Now, our God told us not to use these pieces of paper. He said, you shall not have in your bag an unjust weight or balance. He says, thou shalt not steal. He gave us all the gold and silver in the hills and the mountains. He gave us property, told us to use that, and we woke up one day and said, nah, this God, he doesn't know what he's talking about. He doesn't understand international finance. He doesn't understand the economy. And so we created here in America a Federal Reserve Bank, and this Federal Reserve is issuing paper, and this paper is being bought, sold, and traded by all of us, and hell, you can get anything you want for it. But unfortunately, you can only get all of us together, as in mass, can only get 2% of the goods and services that are out there. 2%. Now, that tells me we've lost 98% of our purchasing power, which is what I told you at the beginning of the program. I mean, we're only arguing over the last 2 or 3 cents here. We're not getting excited about the 97% that's already gone, are we? Now, this is a part and parcel of this thing that we call communism. Communism is predicated upon this fifth plank of the Communist Manifesto, or at least our economy is this fifth plank to the Communist Manifesto, which calls for a central bank. And we call it in this country the Federal Reserve. You people in England call it the Bank of England. In Germany, you call it the Deutsche Bank. And every country in the world has this institution turning out this paper money to impoverish and to steal from the people of the nation. Now, the people are willing pawns in the game. They willingly take this paper money. And they're impoverished thereby. Now, if you would like to get out of this process or this program, you need to quit practicing communism, or at least that fifth plank. Then there's a plank that goes along with it called the second plank, which calls for the heavy progressive income tax, which takes 17%, and is coupled with the eighth plank to Social Security, which takes 16. Now, if you take 17 and 16, that's 33%, children. And so your Kublai Khan over here, your government, the Federal Reserve, is taking 33% of everything that you create and produce, and they're passing that on and giving it to other people. And it buys votes. And you know, the old people in this country, they call Social Security the third rail of politics. And nobody dinks around with Social Security. And so that 16% that's being taken from all you young people is being given to all those old people. And when you take a look at the demographics and the people who vote and the people that don't vote, you know, and that's why you're paying that 16%, and you're going to continue to pay. Well, as long as you want to work for the corporation for paper money. And then on top of that, if you're making any money at all, you got to pay a 17% minimum income tax. Now, let me tell you this, that when you quit practicing communism and you start practicing property and property rights, stop using paper money and use gold and silver, in 36 months, you should have $100,000 worth of gold buried in a hole in the ground dealing in property. Now, that's not great wealth, but it is some wealth. And most of you people out there, if you're an average Joe Sixpack American, you have a mortgage on your house and you have consumer debt worth about $70,000. And you can never make any money while you're in debt. And most of you young college people out there, if you're going to college, you have been buried in debt with your student loans and your credit cards before you ever graduate from college. You've been buried in debt. Now, debt and paper money are the exact opposites to wealth. Now, if you want to get wealthy, you can't do it in debt, and you can't do it with paper money. Now, a lot of people are trying that, and it's not working out well. Now, paper money makes a lot of money for those that issue it and deal in it. I'm not suggesting that banks and insurance companies and politicians and government officials don't make a lot of money off of paper money. You see, the guy that creates the paper money, like the Kublai Khan, he can't lose. But the guy that accepts the paper money over time can't win. I say over time. In short periods of time, and over the short haul, you can, but not over the long haul. And that's the history of paper money in America. So hang on, we'll be back with more on The War on Gold by Anthony Sutton when we come back. Meanwhile, you are listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide over the Internet. If you'd like more information about the law school and The Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, the law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school and is open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. If you'd like more information, please go to our homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated weekly, and it has our radio log, schedule, and archives, and that can be accessed through our website. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events 7 days a week. Now, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, please call the law school at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. The Law Hour and editorial review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that those authors or publications that we endorse or recommend are going to reciprocate. Most of the authors and publications that we cite or use here on the Law Hour are political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint is not necessarily totally endorsed by the Law Hour and editorial review. Now, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the opinions and beliefs of our advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of this network or local radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Or you can call us direct at area code 417-273-4967. And I guess while I'm at it, I'll plug Anthony Sutton's book. Now, I'm not sure if Sutton is still alive. He was born back in the 1920s. So if he was alive today, he'd have to be 86 years old, which is not unreasonable. He certainly could be alive today. He wrote a number of books. He was a college professor, wrote a number of books on economics and one thing and another. I always found his books to be fascinating. Of course, the average Joe Sixpack would look at this as my daughter does and say, oh my God, that is boring, as she would say. It's not just boring, it's boring. And this book was written back in 1976, published in 1977 by 76 Press, Seal Beach, California, The War on Gold by Anthony C. Sutton. To get a copy of it today, I'm sure that it wasn't a bestseller at the time, and I'm sure that the few copies that were printed are well buried in some used bookstore or on somebody else's shelf. I happened to be in a used bookstore, and I saw this for a dollar. And when I saw Sutton's name on there, I said, geez, I can't go wrong for a dollar. This guy always had his fingers on the pulse of our society and of our economy for as long as I could remember, far more so than Katie Couric or Brian Williams. Not to say that Brian and Katie aren't nice people. And God, I just love Katie, and I just really like Brian, but they're just about as dumb as a box of rocks. They do not have their fingers on the pulse of reality, and if they do, they have kept it so well hidden, you'll never find it. Sutton, on the other hand, is a cat of a different breed, and if you would go to your used bookstore and just use the name The War on Gold, Anthony Sutton, they'll type it into their computer, and they'll find a copy of this book someplace in the world, because there's about 500,000 bookstores around the world, 500,000 that subscribe to the service, and they put their inventory on their computers, and then any other bookstore can just tap into that computer inventory, and it just increases the inventory of every store in the world by about the inventory of what's in the other 500,000 stores. It's really a phenomenal service, and I'm sure that you can find a copy of this book. It probably won't be for a dollar, but if it costs you $20, it'll be well worth the $20. And if it costs you more than that, I think it's worth more than that, but you can let your conscience be your guide. Now, the Chinese ultimately found by bitter experience that Marco Polo's admiration for their mulberry bark paper money was not well-founded. History suggests that for money to perform its function, it has to retain an intrinsic value corresponding to its nominal value. Now, the Khan's advisors carefully warned the emperor that mulberry bark paper money was intrinsically worthless and needed specie backing in order for people to have total confidence in its value. So at first, the Chinese mulberry bark paper notes were backed by gold, silver, copper, and iron equal to 3/7 of its outstanding notes. In China, copper and iron performed the function of supplying the required intrinsic value rather than scarce gold and silver. In fact, the origin of Chinese paper money grew out of a problem rarely found elsewhere in the world and the monetary history of the world. Iron and copper specie, especially the heavy iron money of Western China, were too troublesome to pass from hand to hand. So paper money originated as paper bills or receipts for specie passed between private persons, and the state recognized the private profit. They intervened in the transactions and made paper money a state monopoly. About 1000 AD, the state-issued paper money became legal tender and was readily accepted as long as it remained convertible into specie, that is, iron, copper, gold, and silver. The first series of government notes remained convertible for 65 years or so. Then the government limited conversion to a single opportunity every 3 years. In practice, at the end of each 3-year term, few bills were presented for conversion. The consequence was the government became improvident, and the increasing wants of the army induced it at least to use the reserve fund deposited in the bank. After another century, the number of circulating bills was certainly 20 times as much as these first issues, and consequently their value was injured the more. A Chinese author described the money bills of the Mongol dynasty in this fashion. He said, quote, "Already were the bills in consequence of the overissue no more fit in measure the value of all merchandise, and when in consequence of the confusions of war, there was for the government expenditure no sufficient quantity of money to meet the want. Continually new bills were printed. The result was that the bills had no value while commodities fetched high prices, and when at last they were not accepted anymore, that law by which they had been instituted was repealed. At the time that they had their full value, the bills were generally issued and used as balancing money, but in the times of their decay, when the deposit which should have backed them was not sufficient, more paper money was constantly made, till at last they, the bills, were not current anymore." Now, the inflation of the Vietnamese War, followed by suspension of dollar convertibility in 1971, parallels the Chinese situation of 700 years ago. The Chinese wars with the Tartars brought about a vast increase in the money supply, and eager as they had been before to keep the notes in their possession, they were now anxious to redeem them, but though presenting them at the fixed interval, no specie payment was obtained. The holders of these already considerably depreciated bills of exchange received instead of money a new sort of notes called credit notes. Well, children, that's where we are today. You see, if you take your Federal Reserve notes or your checks into the bank, you can get more paper, but you cannot get gold and silver. Now, you can convert these into clad coinage. I mean, you could take your paper at face value and go in and get copper coins, you know, or copper, zinc, or whatever these coins are made of now, but you can't get gold and silver. There's no convertibility into specie. Same thing happened there. Now, this goes on for a while. You know, and then finally, as inflation becomes more and more rampant, it can either go into a deflation or into a hyperinflation. And so we're headed toward hyperinflation, which then ultimately leads to a deflation. And then the government will come and they'll have all kinds of crazy laws. And they'll tell us that we're not patriotic if we don't take these hyperinflated bills. And they'll threaten us with death if we use gold and silver. And they'll confiscate the gold and all kinds of crazy things. Governments that are desperate do desperate things. So it's been the history of paper money from the Chinese who invented the program back in the 13th, or about 1000 AD. It's been around for about 1,000 years. They came up with the program. It's been tested in every country in the world. And it's always failed. And it always fails in about 65 to 75 to 85 years. We Americans have made it work longer than anybody else in history. We are now the champions of paper money. America, we're the champions. And we now have the paper money used worldwide, and the American paper money is being used as the reserve money of all the other nations in the world. So here are the Chinese sitting over there with $1 trillion worth of paper reserves. And they, honest to God, believe that $1 trillion, they can go out into the marketplace and buy $1 trillion worth of oil or $1 trillion worth of Caterpillar tractors or computers or whatever they want to buy. But their money is depreciating at the rate of 10% per year worldwide. That's what the inflation rate is. So they've got $1 trillion in the bank today, and 1 year from now it'll buy $900 billion worth of goods and services. So they're going to lose 10% of their purchasing power in 1 year. And that's where you're at. You're losing 10% of your purchasing power by hanging on to the money. And this is why the savings rate in America is now at minus. People aren't stupid. People are getting rid of the paper. They're not saving that crap. And that's all it is crap. In fact, in Germany, at the height of the hyperinflation over there, it was cheaper to burn the paper money in your stove than it was to convert the paper money to wood and then burn the wood in your stove, because you could get more BTUs of heat value out of the paper than you could out of the wood that the paper could be traded for. That's how worthless the paper became. And when it cost more to print the paper than the government could get out of the paper, they quit and they stopped the inflation and they went on to a new color paper. But when that happens, the people that own property that isn't bought and paid for, that is, they own an equitable interest in the property, lose it. So the house that you have, let's say you've got a $300,000 house and you have $150,000 equity in your house, you will lose your house and your equity. That's the way that game is played. So it's advantageous to get rid of your house today. That is, pass the old maid off onto somebody else. And then you take the $150,000 and you go buy a house that's half the house that you've got today. It's only half as big, it's only half as good, but now you own it free and clear. You stand a better chance of hanging on to that. Same thing with your cars and all of your toys. And that's why we have a negative savings rate. That's why our money is inflating at 10% a year. That's why our economy is in recession. I mentioned this to you the other day. Get your pen and paper out here, boys and girls, and let me show you why you're in recession. Your government's lying to you. And they're telling you, and I saw this on Katie the other day. Katie was interviewing some people on the 6 o'clock news, and they were all extolling the virtues of the American economy, why unemployment is down, and the economy is growing at 1.6% a year, and everything is just going along just real fine and honky-dory, and the price of gasoline is down, and so on. And so I looked at that and I said, I don't think these people are in touch with reality. Now remember, the Federal Reserve back in March of 2006 stopped publishing M3. And M3 is that monetary number that tells you where inflation is. And it has been running 10 to 12% for the last 6 years. I don't believe that the M3 money supply is any less than it was back in March. And according to Bob Chapman and the privateer and the international forecaster, the inflation rate calculated from M1 and M2 is running at about what it was, 10 to 12% over the last 6 years. So let's take the lower number, 10%, and let's put 1.6 underneath it with a minus sign. I know this is higher math, but let's try it. Put 10.0 and then put 1.6, and I think you'll come up with 8.4. Now, if you're inflating your monetary supply by 10% and your growth rate is 1.6%, that gives you a minus 8.4% growth rate. Boys and girls, when the economy is producing at plus 2% or less per year in increase, it's called recession. Your economy is operating at minus 8.4% per year. That's a very steep recession. Now, they've covered this over by printing this money. It makes you feel real good that you've got this money, but your real wages have not increased since 1973. There has been no real wage increase in America since 1973. That's not so good. Now let me give you a little piece here that comes from the privateer. Today, the United States has its armed forces placed inside the borders of 170 other nations, so says the Pentagon itself. Is it to be wondered at that today the United States faces more opposition, right up to outright armed resistance, in so many places around the world than any other nation in the world? Historically, this is inherent in the situation. Act to set up such a situation even in only one place and face later resistance. In the statistical economic history of the United States, one can find truly wondrous things. American real wages for the working man tripled in the years between 1850 and 1913, and the U.S. gross domestic product increased over 500%, having an average of 4.3% annual growth rate from 1870 to 1913. All right, now let me put that in perspective here for you. Right after the Civil War in 1865, America began the greatest growth spurt in our history. And remember, at this point in time, we had gold and silver money in circulation. The history of gold and silver throughout the world's history has always been the same. It produces great growth, great empires, and every great world-ruling city, state, nation, or empire has gotten its start and its success from the use of gold and silver coin. And in every case where those countries, nations, city, states, and empires have collapsed, it has been from the debasing of their monetary system. In every single case. And mankind has never learned in 4,000 years of history that they ought to practice just weights and balances and that they ought to use gold and silver and do not use unjust weights and balances and paper. Even though the God of Abraham told us that, and even though experience has demonstrated that, we human beings have never practiced that. Never. Well, at least not for any sustained period of time. Now, America has been around for about 225 years. Not a great span of time. When we look at the history of the world, we Americans have now used paper money longer than anybody else in the world, but it's on the verge of collapse, and it will certainly collapse just like all paper monies in the past have. And let me give you the numbers again. Between 1850 and 1913, which includes the Civil War, which was a great period of destruction, but in spite of this great period of destruction, from 1850 to 1913, the United States gross domestic product increased 500%. In 63 years, 500%. That's an average of 4.3% annual growth compounded from 1870 to 1913. 1870 to 1913, 4.3%. That was achieved even with the enormous real damage caused by the Civil War. Even more wondrous is the fact that it was done without any inflation of fiat paper money. There was zero inflation. There was no Federal Reserve. And this highly productive era was based upon the barbaric relic of gold, and it was accompanied by an actual deflation of prices. From 1800 to 1913, there was a 30% reduction in the U.S. Consumer Price Index from 43 to 30.6. All right, now in the history of America, when we look at it from 1800 to 1913, that's 113 years, we Americans became the wealthiest, most powerful, prosperous nation in the world with the world's number one military, a number one economy, and the world's number one social structure. Did it with that barbaric rock called gold, which is what the Assyrians and Babylonians and Egyptians and the Romans and the Greeks and every civilization in the history of the world has done, used gold to build that empire. Then when we get to the pinnacle of our power and prestige, then we decide that, well, we either want more or we've had enough, and now we need to go to paper. And paper begins the inevitable slide down the slippery slope. Now, between 1930 and 2006, now you're just talking here about 76 years, about one lifespan, when a dollar was worth 100 cents, it's now worth 97 cents, and it lost 30% of its purchasing power. I think we're down to about 2% now, 2 cents. It lost 30% of its purchasing power just in the 6 years since George Bush was elected. And I'm not blaming that on George Bush. I'm just pointing out that it's on his watch. And if Al Gore had been elected, you'd have the same numbers today, because the president doesn't control the Federal Reserve. That's a private corporation. The Federal Reserve controls the Congress, and it controls the presidency. It's not the other way around. Now, if you'd like to make $100,000 in gold and have that buried in a hole in the ground in the next 36 months, you can do that. You can do that with hard money. But I don't know of anybody that's putting $100,000 worth of paper away in 36 months, not paying one-third of everything you create and produce in taxes. And that's only the tip of the iceberg. Boys and girls, there are 14 taxes that you're paying, 14. The two big ones are Social Security and income tax at 17 and 16.1%. Those are the two biggies. That takes one-third. But you're paying 14 taxes, and that consumes 74% of everything you create and produce. And every one of you are paying that tax. Now, if you could get out from under some, if not all of those taxes, it would be of great benefit to you, wouldn't it? Now, you can do that by practicing gold and silver. You cannot do that by practicing paper. You can do that by practicing the Ten Commandments, but you can't do that by practicing the Ten Planks to the Communist Manifesto. Now, Americans will officially tell you that they are non-communist, while at the same time they practice the second plank to the Communist Manifesto, which calls for a heavy progressive income tax, the fifth plank, which calls for a central bank, the eighth plank, which calls for Social Security, and the tenth plank, which calls for a public school system. Now, boys and girls, America did not become the wealthiest, most powerful, and prosperous nation in the world with a central bank, income tax, Social Security, and public school. In fact, it was after the creation of the income tax, Social Security, central bank, and public school that America entered upon the slippery slope that has now taken us from a 100-cent dollar to a 2-cent dollar, having lost 98% of our purchasing power. Now, I don't want to rain on your parade and tell you to give up your paper money. That's a choice that you have to make for yourself. But it looks like to me that an income tax that takes from you 17% is a lot more than a tithe, which takes 10%. I don't understand why you would rather pay 17% than you would 10. Then add Social Security to that. You know, God only wanted 10% from you kids to run the government. Now with Social Security and the income tax, that's 33%. When you add all the rest of these taxes, it's 74%. Now, why you people would rather pay 74% of everything you create and produce in taxes to a government in opposition to the God of Israel that only wanted 10% is beyond me. But hey, listen, it's a choice that you had to make. It's a choice that you made, and now you got to live with it. But I would suggest that you rethink that, because my common sense tells me that 10% is better than paying 74%. Think about that. And meanwhile, we're going to have to close out. We're running out of time. And so I need to remind you that you've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide over the Internet. For more information about The Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. If you'd like more information, just go to the homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. The Law School is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Time's up. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station. God willing, of course, so until then. Thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, Clint.